Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, September 29th. I'm Ray Graff. He is back again. Richard P. Guthrie is on the line to answer your birding questions. So if you have a question about birds, we really have an expert in the house. Metaphorically, he's on the phone, but the feed comes into the house. The number is 800-348-2551. If you have a question about birds, 800-348-2551. Always a popular show when Rich is here. So call early, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie and your birding questions coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hi again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We're discussing birds today. Whenever we do that, we bring in our resident avian expert, Rich Guthrie. Rich is retired from the New York State DEC. He's a board member of the State Ornithological Association and the regional reviewer for the premier birding site, eBird. If you have a birding question, I advise you to call early, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie, welcome back, sir. How you doing?
Good afternoon, Ray. I'm doing great and nice to be here.
We had a beautiful sight in our backyard. Now, I know blue jays, they get a bad rap. They're not good neighbors. They're kind of nasty. But I love blue jays, and I just went out.
Me too.
I just went out back, and we have this nice old stone water. What do they call it? Bird bath, and there were two just sitting there. And man, they're impressive looking birds.
They most certainly are, and you know we're very lucky to have them. You know, as common as they are, numerous and plentiful and widespread and versatile, they are still a major attraction for our area. I mean, they're just so bold and delightful. Their attitude is spunky, and they're there. They make themselves known when they're there, and they're kind of nice to look at.
You know, it occurs to me that I don't even know what one sounds like. What does a blue jay sound like?
Well, actually, the word jay gets its name from the sound of the bird.
Yeah.
They basically say that. However, the blue jay is kind of like a talented songster, and none of it is ever actually musical, except for one or two occasions when they make a mistake and they get kind of like chortly in a musical sense.
Yeah.
But they basically squawk and say jay a lot, and occasionally will make a rattling sound. And every now and then, my favorite sound, and this is the one I was referring to, is kind of musical, is their clothesline song. It sounds like somebody pulling an old rusty clothesline.
Yes, that I've heard. We have a lot of blue jays in our backyard, so that one I have heard. Well, we have a number of emails here, and while the phone lines are loading up, let's do a couple of those. This one came in quite a while ago, early this afternoon. Rich, this morning at 6:45 a.m., we found this small owl sitting in the road, eyes closed, cars passing. We gently wrapped him in a small blanket, thinking he may be injured. He made a few click sounds, stretched his wings, but talons remained clasped on the blanket. I checked his body, can't find any damage except for a bit of blood on the beak. Could he be recovering from shock of a car hit, resting, or playing dead? For now, he's in a large and closed chicken run, alone, wrapped lightly, placed on a ladder. What to do next? Is it a common screech owl? A lot of questions there from Mindy in Stuyvesant. What do you think?
Yes, and thank you. Jackie sent me a copy of the photograph.
Oh, great.
Of this that the people had sent in.
Yeah.
And it is a screech owl, okay. Technically the eastern screech owl. But, yeah, unfortunately, finding it in the road in that condition means, you know, certainly it got hit by a car.
Oh, boy.
That's not good. The thing to do with it is, first of all, is to put it in a dark enclosure for the time being so that it all those distracting things that are going on out there will not be bothering it. I mean, it's going to be on high alert to the extent that it's alert. And we need it to calm down. Also, get it to a licensed rehabilitator. And if you go to the New York State or in other states, their representative government entity that licenses these volunteer rehabilitators who dedicate a lot of time, effort, and money to taking care of injured wildlife like that. And if you go to the New York State Wildlife Rehabilitators, let me see, it's called dec.gov. Mm-hmm. Oh, and there's a long address. But look for licensed wildlife rehabilitators in New York State. And then you could search down by county.
Okay.
And see the name, location, and contact information for nearby rehabilitators. Now, this one, you need one that has a specialty of handling hawks and owls.
Okay.
And in Columbia County, there are a few. In Rensselaer County, let me see, I have that page. And Ulster County, there are a few. And, you know, they're few and far between. Saratoga County, there are a few. Those are the ones in New York State.
Okay.
In for listeners in other areas, there are other licensed. These are state and federal licensed rehabilitators. They're trained to do what they're supposed to do, and they do it, for the most part, they do it very well. So it's unfortunate, but the owl was probably chasing a mouse that was crossing the highway. Easy pickings. And they have really no sense of the speed of cars coming.
Mm-hmm.
And they just don't have the wherewithal to avoid getting hit.
I mean, there's only so much a rehabilitator can do, though, right? If a bird
yes,
is hit
right.
by a car, that bird may be a goner.
You're absolutely right. But in many cases, it may be just a concussion or a temporary stunned injury.
Yeah.
If it's a broken wing or the like, they do wonders in repairing broken wings and then returning birds back to the wild. And sometimes the birds are not releasable, in which case they can serve as an education bird by going to displays or serving as an opportunity for people to learn about birds. And I'll bring something up about that a little bit later on when we talk about events.
Sure, we'll do that coming up within the next half hour or so. This email came in from John in Pittsfield. John writes, I had some eastern phoebes in a nest under the porch during the summer, and then around late July, early August, they left and robins moved in. My question is, do robins steal other birds' nests? And that's from John in Pittsfield.
Well, stealing is kind of a harsh word. I would say repurposing is more like it. Huh. And, robin and other birds, a few other birds, will take advantage of a nesting opportunity if they're fortunate enough to find a vacant nest. And but they will not, for the most part, most birds will not displace another bird that's on a nest. Once a bird is on a nest, they become very defensive, and it's very difficult for another bird to come in and say, kind of like take over.
Okay.
But once the nest is abandoned, then other birds, and it's a few instances where it does happen. Most birds prefer to build their own nest, make it their own.
Yeah. All right. This is the last email, and then we'll take a quick break and then hit the phones. The number here, if you want to talk to Rich Guthrie, and who doesn't, 800-348-2551 is our number, 1-800-348-2551. All right, Rich, this comes from Andrew in Southern Washington County. And he writes, we had a nest of olive-sided flycatchers in May under our porch. We had a bad storm come through, wipe out the nest. Then another nest showed up by the garage. The family came and went safely. I believe I saw one again a few weeks ago, but thought they were out of town by now. Is this common where they'll re-nest? Do they stay in this late of portion of the year?
Yes and yes and no.
Oh.
And the no actually comes first. The no part is that, was not olive-sided flycatcher.
No.
Sorry.
No?
No.
Okay.
Phoebe, yes.
Okay.
They're the ones that nest under the porch. The olive-sided flycatcher is quite rare in the area, and they nest way up north in Washington County, but further north and in open beaver swamps or bogs. They're not a backyard nesting bird.
Okay.
So the phoebe is the one. It's also a flycatcher, and they're the ones that will nest under the porch. And, yes, they will relocate if something happens to the previous nest.
Okay.
No, and yes.
Fair enough.
No, yes, and yes.
All right, now you're confusing me. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551 is our number. Rich Guthrie is on the show today. Your call's coming up. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here, 800-348-2551. The number, it's Rich Guthrie Day on the program. We talk birds, and let's go to Hope in Peru, Massachusetts. Hiya, Hope.
Hi. Hi, Rich. Hi. I have an unidentifiable hawk. It soared past me in the backyard, and it was very mottled and dark brown and black in color all over. Had a hawk's head, and its body was very sleek as well as its wings. Does that sound like anything I've never seen?
Sounds like darn near every hawk that I come across. I'm just kidding. It sounds very much like an immature of one of the many various kinds. And the unfortunate thing about these hawks, the young ones all look pretty much alike. They have a lot of common features. The mottling appearance, the streaking, and size and shape matters. And it's kind of hard to judge the size of a hawk because you really kind of need a relative comparison close by to be able to say. But you can. Is it blue jay size? Is it crow size? Is it larger than a crow? Or eagle size?
It's pretty long and sleek. Definitely larger than blue jay and crow.
Okay. Well, that narrows it down. The chunky hawks, we could move those aside, and that would include things like the red-tail hawk and the red-shouldered hawk.
It had no girth like that, and I saw no white of any kind, just dark brown and black.
Okay. Well, it's beginning to narrow down to one of the occipital hawks, which are, as you described, long and sleek, and they come in three sizes. A very large goshawk, which is bigger than a crow, the Cooper's hawk was about the size of a crow, and a sharp shin hawk, which is about the size of a blue jay. But unfortunately, there's a lot of overlap in the fringe in the size areas of these birds. So again, I'm going to say it was, since it was in the yard or in the back area, and it was probably one of the occipiters, and I'm going to suggest it was a Cooper's hawk at some point.
Okay, because we have many of those, and I've seen sharp-shinned and many, mostly Coopers, but this one was so dark. This was so dark in color, completely black and brown, that I was kind of puzzled because, it had no markings except dark brown and black.
Wow.
I had earlier in the day, I had a witness say, I just came in and saw a strange hawk fly out of the neighbor's yard. And when it was described to me, it was pretty much as I have just said. So I know it's I don't know.
Well, this calls for a picture.
Okay.
I would welcome that.
Do you have one, Hope?
I would. Unfortunately, this happened about the time of your last show, and it was so quick, it was so fast that neither one of us was able to take a picture. It was kind of impossible, but I wish I had, because I've certainly never seen anything like it, and since I had a witness, I knew I wasn't hallucinating.
That's always a
good thing. I'll add another suggestion in there, and that is, a hawk that will look dark like that, black and having a white pattern, could actually be a peregrine falcon. The adult birds like that in a deep gray-black coloration to them. And the Merlin, which is smaller, might have a similar pattern, but not as contrasting as the peregrine falcon. So there's that.
Long length. Yeah.
Right, Hope, we got to roll it along here, but thank you very much for a very interesting call here. Rich Guthrie is our guest, 800-348-2551. Mary in Del Mar, you're next.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I'm wondering why in over the past month I haven't had any birds, not sparrows, no goldfinches. In the summer when the heat was really bad, I could barely keep up with feeding them and even just changing the water and the bird bath, and I was just wondering if other people were experiencing this.
Well, I can join you in on that observation because the same thing is happening here. I was just noticing that this morning. They're darn few, and I keep daily records. I submit this stuff to eBird so I can look back and compare dates and numbers and various types. And, you're right, Mary. They're scarcer now, and it's all about food, I have to say. Many of the birds have, of course, have migrated south, and there are many birds that are yet to arrive. But the birds that are around, the blue jays, the chickadees, the nuthatches, the woodpeckers, they've sort of dispersed into the woods, finding their own sources of natural foods. But rest assured, pretty good bet they'll be back.
Okay, good, because I was wondering, like, maybe they were bored with my food, so I put fresh food out, I put fresh suet out, you know, thinking, okay, and I cleaned the feeders and everything, and nothing.
Yeah, good for you. Well, don't sweat it. It sounds like you're doing a good job, and, they love you.
Okay,
they'll be back.
Good.
All right.
All right, thanks so much.
Mary, thank you for the call. Rich Guthrie is our guest today, and the number is 800-348-2551. Cheryl is in Conway, Massachusetts. Cheryl, you're on.
Hi. I'm calling with a question about flickers. Every fall around this time, my wildlife camera out in the yard catches, like, groups of flickers on the lawn pecking, 10, 15 flickers. What are they doing down out of the trees on the lawn in the fall?
Well, good for you. The flicker is a type of woodpecker. And as you note, they've come out of the trees. They feast on the ground. They've adapted to taking ants on the ground. That's one of their main menu items. And right now, the flickers are migrating. So there'd be an unusually higher number of flickers going through choice areas. And it sounds to me like you got the choice area for them.
Oh, very interesting. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you
very much.
Well,
good for you with that camera, too, and a good way to monitor what's going on when you're not able to.
Do you have one of those set up at your house, Rich?
I do, but the battery keeps running down.
Oh, my gosh.
I know.
What's the most interesting bird that you caught unexpectedly on the camera?
Well, let me see. Not so much the birds, but I've had, a nice variety of wildlife come through there and to pick up on there. You know, just the normal suburban backyard things, like raccoons, chipmunks and squirrels and skunks and possums and the like. Fortunately, no longer cats. I don't know. Neighbors with cats have moved, and so I'm not getting the cats in there anymore, and that's good news.
I think probably the neighbors know better than to send the cats over to your neck of the woods. Right, Rich?
Good advice.
Let's go to Marianne in Copaic, New York. Marianne.
Hello.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
Rich, I talked to you. I talked to you a few years ago. I have a business, a non-lethal goose control, and we chase geese with my border collies. And are you still there?
Oh, yeah, we're listening. Go ahead.
Yep, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I couldn't hear that. But anyway, my question is, first of all, you had told me to call back at some time, and it's been very successful. All my clients are really pleased. It's been quite a few years, but they really are just about geese-free. And when I first started, they were just they're right on the Hudson, and they were just bombarded with geese all the time.
Yeah.
But I just was reading the last few weeks, there's been open season on geese. And you can get 15, you can shoot 15 resident Canada geese and only two migrating Canada geese. And I just wondered exactly how you could really tell which kind you were shooting.
That's a great question.
Well, it's all about the timing. The migrating geese are basically essentially not here yet. So any of the geese that are around, you can pretty well assume are the resident geese. And the season for those that where hunting is permitted in our area begins on the 1st of October. 1st of September, I beg your pardon. And so the only geese that would be around at that time will be the resident geese. And then beginning the 1st of October, the 1st of October, the migrant geese will be coming through. So And you can't tell one from the other other than by association and perhaps where they happen to be located. But the migrant geese aren't here yet. So
there you go. All right.
So the geese that are here, the resident geese that don't migrate, there wouldn't be any migrating geese with them, is what you're saying. Okay.
That's right. Yep.
All right. Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you. That answers my question.
Super. I appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Rich Guthrie is our guest. And John, where are you calling from?
Hey, I'm calling from Clavrick.
Oh, Clavrick. Okay. Well, go ahead.
Okay. Hey, hey, Ray. Hey, Rich.
Hello.
Hi. So, in my area, I was driving one day and saw a rather large white bird sitting on a fence and hadn't seen something that big. So I figured I'd pull over and take a look at it. And I thought it was a seabird at first. And I took a look at it and looked like a hawk. So I did a little research online. Turns out it's a white red-tailed hawk. And I'm wondering if you've heard of that before. I'm sure you have. I saw an article in the Times Union from about 10, 15 years ago saying there's about 6 or 8 of them in the Albany area, and they're always females. So is that true?
Well, yes. And in fact, that was an article that I had written.
No.
And of course it's true.
I figured.
And yes, these white red-tailed hawks are really kind of a very interesting anomaly in the hawk world. And there seems to be this genetic trait that's out there that occurs periodically or sporadically in various areas, not only in the Northeast, but right across the country. I know since writing that, I've gotten indication correspondence from folks out in the Midwest and even out in the far West telling me that they had similar white red-tailed hawks in their area. So yes, and good for you. The one in the Clavrick area, I believe, has been around for a number of years and ranges
yes,
up and down along Route 9H and the Taconic, where people driving by will notice it there. They're very conspicuous when they're out there, and you can see them.
I've seen it multiple times. My other question would be, how long do red-tailed hawks live?
Well, most hawks, not that long, but a surviving hawk, one that can make it past the first couple of years, can actually live for quite a long time. They can live up to 30 years.
Wow.
When I've been tagging hawks, I caught one that was already 20 years old, and others have caught older hawks like that. And research has shown that these birds can actually live for a long time. And these white red-tailed hawks are one of the good ones to monitor for longevity because they are distinctive. I know one down in Millbrook, New York, was nesting for 15 consecutive years, and another one over in Ulster County for a similar 15 or 20 years. So
amazing.
They are quite long-lived.
All right, John, thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Rich Guthrie is our guest. And let's grab at least one more here before our next break. Kathy in Bennington. Kathy.
Hi. I have kind of an unusual situation here. I don't know if you can really answer this, but Sunday I was messing around in my yard. I live out actually in Shaftesbury, which is kind of out in the middle of the boonies. Mm-hmm. And there was a dead bird in my yard. It was rather large, and I got to looking at it. It wasn't very long dead, maybe a day at the most. And the head was off. And I looked it up. I figured out it was a common snipe, which, first of all, was very odd to have, I think, in my yard where I live. And the other thing that really kind of was weird to me is that nothing ate it. And I set it aside, and the next day, nothing had touched it. And I have plenty of wildlife around that would eat something like that. I don't know if something's wrong with the bird, if that's common. The whole thing was rather weird.
Well,
thoughts?
Yes, a couple of thoughts. First off, the snipe is a type of sandpiper that has kind of given up the beach for the forest and the lower 40 wetlands. And they they're out there in Vermont, in New York, in Massachusetts, where they nest a little bit further to the north or in northern type of habitats. And the snipe is a wonderful bird. They have a wonderful display pattern when they're out there in courtship during the spring. But the a headless, you know, the real story out there is that with a headless dead bird or other creature, is usually the product of a predator, a raptor of some sort, and probably a hawk. And as it happens, many times a hawk will take just the head and move on, either be scared off the carcass or whatever reason. And why it's left behind for other creatures, why the other scavengers haven't picked it up, is a bit of a mystery. And I've seen that happen other times as well, with what looks like really, you know, perfect opportunity for a raccoon or a skunk or a coyote to come and snag an easy meal, and they just pass it up. And I don't think it's anything specific about the individual bird or the offering. It's just a matter of they maybe have better opportunities, a better, you know, fresher food that they prefer. It's hard to say, but I've seen that happen as well.
Well, that's interesting that you said it was a hawk, because that was the only other thing I could figure that might do something like that without eating it. The head was still there. That's the only way I could identify it. And I thought, well, maybe it's, and I do have hawks around there, but and owls. So I thought, well, maybe that's the only thing. He was protecting his territory or something. I don't know. It was weird, but I just thought maybe you would know. So thanks very much. Well, I appreciate this.
Oh, okay. And, you know, the other thing that comes to mind is if another cause of death might have been a collision with either a wire or a window or unlikely a low-hanging branch or something of that sort, you know, some sort of mishap more naturally occurring.
I mean, but, is it common for a bird to be decapitated by a low-hanging branch?
Well, no. But then something might have come along. Oh, I thought in the second statement there that the head was still there.
It was.
I'm sorry.
It was. Yeah. But okay. I mean, it wasn't. It was lying next to the body, presumably, right?
Oh, next to. I'm sorry. I missed that part.
All right. Well, let's take a break. This is all getting very, very dark. 800-348-2551 is our number. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Ah, some beautiful music now to take us to break, Zachary. Oh, that's nice. Okay, we've had our relaxing music, and now it's time to get back to the program. Rich Guthrie is here on Vox Pop. The number is 800-348-2551. Lines are completely loaded at the moment. If you hear somebody hang up, you can give it a shot. Rich, this will be the time of the program where you can tell us about things that are going on.
Well, things are happening out there. Things are beginning to pick up in terms of group activities after that long period of silence. But right now we're in a bit of a trough in the wave of bird migrants. Most of the bug eaters are gone, but not all. The seed eaters and raptors are next, followed by waterfowl once things begin to freeze further north. With all of these things, I encourage folks to get on to ebird.org and let us know what's going on so we can keep track and also provide some long-term data. The sparrows, they're the kind of guys that right now are the show stealers. The little plain brown wrapper mystery birds that are out there. A challenge. There's lots of them. And they're beginning to become the predominant bird species in the backyards. We'll be followed by the winter finches and their friends, the crossbills, siskins, nuthatches, longspurs, and the like, as winter comes on. Now, hummingbirds. The hummingbirds are mostly gone, but not all of them. So if you've been keeping a hummingbird feeder, keep it out there. This is about the time when some of the rare western ones and the vagrants from far away begin to show up. The rufous, calliope, broadtail, any of those rare hummingbirds may be back showing up. Pictures, eBird, email, let me know so we can check them out. And then the vagrants. This is also the time when the young birds from far afield begin to wander around. They're lost. They're misdirected. Any flycatcher, kingbird, or odd-looking feeder bird, such as the western warblers and the like, e-bird, email, let me know. So, and a couple of programs. Let me talk about a couple of programs.
Sure.
New York State Ornithological Association, I encourage folks to check it out, nybirds.org. They have the Young Birders Club. This is for school-age kids around the state to get together and work cooperatively with one another, learn from each other. And Hudson Mohawk Bird Club is having a program October 5th. This is a virtual program online, Birding Southeast Arizona, with Scott and Denise Hackett Stoner, two award-winning photographers who will be presenting birds of the desert valleys to sky islands of Southeast Arizona.
Okay.
That will be online, hmbc.net. The Mearns Bird Club down in Orange and Rockland counties will be doing the Stewart State Forest on the 5th of October. And then on October 11th, which is a Sunday, the Storm King Art Center. This is a world-famous sculpture park.
Oh, yeah.
Admission is free if you join the club and participate in this field trip. MearnsBirdClub.org. The Waterman Bird Club. Tomorrow we'll be going to Norrie Point. RTWBC.org. And next Wednesday, October 7th, the Cary Institute of Ecological Studies. The Burroughs Natural History Society will be doing a sparrow walk October 3rd. Sparrows on the Farm. This is the Burroughs Natural History Society, jbnhs.org.
Swell.
Hudson River Audubon Society down there in Yonkers will be going to Lenoir Preserve for Hawk Day on Saturday, October 3rd at 1 in the afternoon. That's HRAS, Hudson River Audubon Society.org. And Mass Audubon, Friday morning bird walks in Worcester, October 9th, and Fall Nature Walk at Quabbin Reservoir, October 11th, MassAudubon.org. That's what's coming up.
Fantastic. And if people want to get in touch with you, Rich, how do they do that?
Richard P. Guthrie, P as in Peter, richardpguthrie@gmail.com.
All right, let's go back to the phones. And David in Lamontville has been waiting a long time. David, you're up.
Oh, hi, guys. Good afternoon.
Hi.
I live in a wooded area, good-sized pond, and there's a bird that I haven't seen, but I hear it. It makes... it doesn't have a song. It goes like a clock.
Oh, I know what you're doing. Yeah. Are you ready?
So can you
not a bird.
Yeah.
It's not a bird?
Not a bird.
What is it?
Chipmunk.
Ah, the chipmunk.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought it was
I've been fooled by them many times myself because they have that bird-like sound. It's very, very persistent. And they're rather incessant, but you can tell after a while they begin to quicken up, and the tempo increases. So there you go. You got yourself a chipmunk trying to trick you.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for the
call.
You're
quite welcome.
And now over to another David, this one in Little Falls. David, you're on.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call. I note I have a family of cardinals in my backyard this year, quite a few of them, and I noticed the male, the adult male, seemed to look very raggedy. I was wondering if he was molting and if that's something I can expect this time of year. And I had a second question as well. But
all right. Well, let's go with the first
one. Exactly what you said. The adult birds are molting right now, male and female. The young birds have fresh new feathers, so there's no need for them to go through the molt. But the adult birds, they're shedding the old ones and putting on new ones.
Okay, and question number two.
I'm glad that he's healthy. He looked a little raggedy. My other question was about, and I'm not even sure about the time now, but I think it's about 7 years ago, I noticed a very distinct new bird song in my neighborhood. And I do pay attention to these things, so it was very startling. I couldn't match up the song with any bird that I was able to observe for about 3 years. And then I finally spotted him. It was just a little brown, nondescript bird. I was able to find him in my bird book. It's a Carolina wren. Beautiful song.
You got it.
Beautiful note.
Yep.
And I was wondering if you had any comments about their relocating in this area or anything like that.
Oh, very good.
Seems around quite a bit.
Yeah, Carolina wren. You nailed it. They have an interesting, rather long checkered history. They come and go periodically as their range is actually expanding northward. And sometimes they go over the bounds of nature, and the hard winters will take their toll, and they give them a bit of a setback. But over the course of the years, they become more hardy, and more importantly, the seasons have become milder. And so they are actually expanding into and a reflection of changes in the climate in the area. So you're right about that. The Carolina wren is a newcomer, as the name suggests. It is from the south, and they are right on the heels of the cardinal and the mockingbird and the titmouse and some of the other southern birds that are now in the area.
David, thanks a lot for the call. Rich Guthrie is our guest. Rich, we have so many emails. I'll never get to all of them, but this one caught my eye, and maybe very quickly before the next call you can answer this. Who wrote it? It doesn't say. Oh, Roger wrote this. Roger says, are hummingbirds attracted by any sounds? Early in September, on several occasions, hummingbirds would fly over my chimes and hover and then fly to the bee balm or other flowers.
Not likely. There's nothing in sound that would appeal to a hummingbird per se. So it's probably something about. Let me just guess. and based on some, that it's not something that we know that they can respond to. So color, yes. There may be something about the chime, either a reflection or the coloration or maybe a rainbow hue that it emanates.
Yeah.
There may be something about it, but I doubt very much it's the sound itself.
All right, let's go back to the phones here. And Jim in Goshen. Jim, you're on.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. So I live deep in the woods on the side of a mountain, and I have had robins and phoebes both. Nesting every year in my property. Usually the phoebe is in an outbuilding up in the eaves, and the robin is in a rhododendron right out front of my living room window so I can watch it making its nest. But one year the phoebe decided to make its nest in the eave next to the house, right near the robin's nest. And one thing I've seen with these robins, every year they come and they attack the window in my basement where they see their reflection. It's like they're very aggressive. They just she keeps on like pounding against the window. Anyway, the year that the phoebe made her nest up near the robin's nest, after about a couple of weeks, the nest was destroyed, and I saw that the baby phoebe was on the ground and it was dead. And I think that the robin was the one that did that. And I'm just wondering if you would concur that they're kind of an aggressive bird.
No, I can't go along with that. There's only
okay.
So many other possibilities there. Some other birds may be the actual culprit, or perhaps some mammal or, chipmunk or some other cause. And the cowbird also is a possibility. So I would not blame it on the robin. I think the robin is more tolerant of a phoebe nest in its own territory. So, nope, not the robin. Not one of the usual suspects.
Okay, Jim, thank you very much for the call. And let's go to Helen in Milford. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Hello.
I need to talk to you about a very dark subject as well.
Oh, boy. All right.
Oh, boy.
I'm a chicken keeper. So the first thing you know is raptors and I are not friends.
Right.
Now, I have had the opportunity this summer to experience death on an ultimate level. I got in 60 new pullets this spring. I'm now down to 30.
Oh, boy. That's terrible.
My killer has been identified by a body feather and a trail cam. It is a great horned owl. Mm-hmm. Latest casualty was a black australorp this morning.
Yikes.
How do I encourage this critter to seek life elsewhere?
Yeah, that's a good one. Rich.
It's kind of like asking a dog not to breathe. I mean, this is what owls do, and backyard chickens or farmyard chickens are easy prey for them, and an enclosure for the chickens might be the best and only realistic opportunity or solution. That owl knows
birds,
that there's.
Go ahead, Helen.
My birds are kept because I also have predatory dogs in the area. My birds, I have a flock of 50 and now a flock of 30. They are secured behind fencing. So I've got that part squared away. What I need to figure out is how would you suggest I cover, now one fence yard is 3/4 acre, the other is a 1/2 acre. How do I protect them from death from above?
Yikes, that's tough.
Well, you got it. It's from above. And so an enclosure that includes protection from above is what you are alluding to. And, when it comes to that, that may be the answer to what you have there. I mean, what else could you do to dissuade an owl that is looking for an easy meal? I mean, that's how they earn their living. And you're not going to talk them out of it. So there's few other choices that you have on hand.
Now, what I'm trying to figure out is can I feasibly cover an enclosure of that size?
Oh, boy.
Or do I need to bring it in?
Well, no, you. I can't imagine that you would have a reasonable cover that to go over an acre of area. There are movable chicken enclosures that you can bring around and give the chickens fresh turf periodically by moving them inside this enclosure. It's like a prairie wagon. On wheels with
they call them chicken tractors.
There you go.
However, I don't have the opportunity for it comes down to I've got two fairly large flocks, so moving them in a tractor and then keeping that tractor that entire area that they're on covered is the answer is eluding me now.
Either way, it's going to be expensive, I bet you, Helen. You have to build something.
I don't want to be glib, but maybe chickens is not the answer. Maybe sheep or something.
That is being glib, Rich, and it's not being very helpful to our friend, Helen.
I know,
sorry,
but look
Helen.
At what we're faced with.
Considering that what I do is I sell my eggs at a farmer's market. So, chickens is, this is it.
Chickens is it.
So, well, let me ask you a question, Helen. And, of course, I'm not a chicken raiser. I know nothing about such things. But couldn't you just put them in, on a 1/4 acre and cover that? Do they have to have a full acre to run around?
What I'm thinking of doing is I have some dog kennel panels, the 5 by 6 foot tall panels.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking of putting them on the end of my permanent coops. My coops are both of them are 10 by 24, so they're good size. They don't move.
Yeah. Hey, Helen, I gotta say, I gotta apologize,
and then I'm
Helen.
I'm thinking about maybe I can put some chicken wire over the top of that.
Well, now you're talking. That sounds to me like the where you really do want to go you've thought out the reasonable alternatives, and there you go with one.
All right, time out. Count Basie's playing. The show's almost over. So, Helen, thank you very much, and Rich Guthrie, once again, your email address.
RichardPGuthrie@gmail.com.
All right, brother. Thanks for being here. Support comes from Bergeron Electrical Services for over 30 years, providing the Pioneer Valley in western Massachusetts with all electrical services, interior and exterior lighting, generator installation, and more. BergeronElectrical.net. Boyden and Perrin, Amherst, Massachusetts, providing foreign and domestic car, truck, and SUV repair services at a Massachusetts inspection station for over 50 years. BoydenandPerrin.com. And the Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked breads, pastries, all special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings, open Tuesday through Friday, 7 to 4, Saturday, 7 to 2, henyonbakery.com. Once again, thanks to the incomparable Rich Guthrie for being here. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Kayleen White took the calls. Our producer's Jackie Orchard. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow, it's Pets und Vets with Dr. Carrie O'Loughlin. Stand by now for the book show.